Welcome to Biennale to go, the podcast for the Biennale für aktuelle Fotografie 2022 in Mannheim, Ludwigshafen and Heidelberg. The individual episodes of this podcast are intended to offer the visitors the opportunity to engage with a range of works from the Biennale on their way between the six exhibition venues. This is because the length of the individual episodes depends on how one moves from one exhibition to the next, on foot, by bicycle, by public transport or by car. Both the artist and the curator will have their say. Have fun with it.
Hello everyone for another episode of Biennale to go, the podcast for the Biennale 2022 with the title From Where I Stand. And I'm walking right now with Rune Petersen to the Kunsthalle Mannheim. We started at Rice Engelhorn Museum right now. And we would like to invite the audience to walk with us to the next exhibition, to the exhibition called Contested Landscapes. And first of all, I would like to quote a part of the concept so everyone understands where we are going. And the exhibition, Contested Landscapes, is dedicated to the ecological challenges facing the world today. For centuries, imperialist and capitalist aspirations have led to the exploitation of the earth. Nature is seen as a resource for economic growth. Its economic value outweighs the ecological value. But in the face of climate change, a rethink is needed. The question is how we can rebalance the relationship between humans and the environment to enable future generations to live more sustainably. So, hello, Rune.
Hi. Nice to be here.
And would you first introduce yourself to the audience?
Yes, sure. My name is Rune Petersen. I'm a Danish artist living in Brussels at the moment. Yeah, what else do you need, actually?
Well, what are you doing for
what
a living,
am I doing?
Maybe?
Okay, for a living. Well, I work as an artist and I teach at an art academy in Breda in the Netherlands.
Ah, okay.
And that basically keeps me from the streets. I'm here for the exhibition, invited by Iris.
Invited by Iris.
That's, yes.
what a good point. So your work, Robia?
Yeah.
I pronounce it well?
Very well, very well, yes.
Could you tell us something? What's this work about?
Sure. It's about it's about several things, but in essence, it's about an area in the north of Denmark where my family has had a sort of a summer vacation space for or houses for four generations. And this area has always been sort of a little bit of a mystical area for us as because of the way the landscape has formed. So I decided for this particular project, I wanted to look at the formation of the landscape up there and how that had over the centuries, and actually since the last ice age, how that had been transformed in part by sort of natural and geological occurrences, but also by how men or humans have exploited and used the landscape, and how this has led to different types of landscapes within the last sort of 1,000 years, which sort of, questioned the idea of what is an original landscape, and notions of extraction, but also notions of preservation.
Okay, and
of landscapes.
Well, maybe what is man-made?
Not only that, but what are the consequences of man's action?
Okay.
I think more.
Maybe I read about something about a dune that is moving.
Yeah, the sort of the pivot point was that in the 16th and 17th century, this area was hit by enormous sand drift. So sand simply coming from the sea and from the beaches and migrating as enormous dunes, so more than one dune,
okay,
but as enormous small deserts basically, and covering villages and farms and fields, etc., in its way. And the reason for that, that the sand all of a sudden came, had to do with the way that the land had been exploited. So all the trees had been cut down, all the fields had been sort of over-extracted, the cattle and the livestock had been grazing in the what do you call it, the fields and the hills, etc. So that within about 100 years, this very fertile landscape developed into a big barren wasteland, a desert basically. And that was obviously quite frustrating for the people living there.
Okay, and your family?
Well, no. They come later.
They come later, okay.
No. So this is in the 16th, 17th centuries. So it becomes a very impoverished area. Later on in the 18th century, poets and writers who travel there write about it as this sort of enormous white land covered with sand, yeah. The Pompeii of the North, etc.
Oh, okay. They called it the Pompeii of the North.
Yeah. That was Hans Christian Andersen who traveled there and was really scared. But anyway, but the interesting part is that then in the late 1800s attracts a group of artists. Or actually, I should just mention that before that, a lot of sort of measurements had been put in place in order to try to do something about it. So regrow the forest, etc. But it was very hard to get anything to grow in this
sand.
In this sand, yeah. Okay. And salt, etc. So from about 1800, an initiative, actually a law was enacted that tried to sort of organize the whole thing a bit better, and a lot of plants were imported from abroad that were capable of growing there. And this is an interesting part because this is sort of at the same time of the Enlightenment in the rest of Europe, etc. And up until then, the peasants who were living there had thought more of it as, you know, this is just, there's nothing we can do about this.
Yeah, okay, so
this is the work of God.
How did you manage to build a body of artistic work out of this? So what will we see?
Well, that's then because in the late 19th century, a group of artists came there looking for this sort of romantic notion of the landscape and became, or sort of, yeah, made a lot of paintings about this area and became sort of very fascinated by this barren landscape, this primordial landscape. And those artists led to a little bit of an early gentrification. And here's where my family comes into the point.
Okay.
Tourism, you know, a different economy led to tourism evolving instead of agriculture. So the land, which was still sandy, was actually now valuable because of something else, you know, beaches.
Yeah.
And so my great-grandfather built a house there. And then it has been in my generations, there have been built several more houses since then. And the landscape has, in the last sort of 100 years since he settled there, changed dramatically as well. It has actually sort of returned to the state, in a sense, that it was before the sand drift, so 500 years ago. Mm-hmm. However, and this is then the clue of the whole thing, sort of, is that now a preservation is going on that wants to return the landscape to the sandy landscapes.
Okay.
Sort of based on this romantic view of the painters,
yeah, okay,
et cetera,
okay.
et cetera. So in order to preserve that landscape, now the imported trees, et cetera, that were brought in to...
Okay. What an idea. Know,
they're now being cut
to change
down.
Change again.
Yeah, they're seen as invasive species and being cut down so that we can preserve the original landscape.
Okay.
So the idea of what is original, etc., is very fluid.
Obviously.
And that's sort of my main question within the whole thing. You know, the landscape is always in transition. How much control do we have over it, and how can you even attempt to preserve something like that?
Okay, so I think this is a video work.
Yeah, it's a video work.
So what do we see in this video?
Well, it's sort of a very, I guess it's pretty straightforward. It's a lot of slow shots, or long sort of still shots from the area, which I went there. I obviously know it very well. So I went there, I shot over a few over a few seasons. I was lucky enough to go there last year when there was snow all over the place, so I could sort of start from this notion of the ice age. I'm not trying to make it look like, you know, we're back in time or anything, but it does sort of support the narrative of starting in the Ice Age. So you see a very, 30-minute video consisting of, I think, about 8 to 10 chapters, basically. And in between those chapters are sort of, as hallmarks are, maps of the time.
Oh,
so I take geographical descriptions, basically, of the area, which have also changed dramatically, of course, starting from 1450 and then up until Google Maps, basically. Mm-hmm. So you also see the way that that we draw maps and what we concentrate on and how this sort of helps our, I guess, our notion of, you know, if you draw something, you put names on it, you could try to control it. Mm-hmm. But they are also snapshots because the landscape itself changes over time. So I thought that was interesting. And next to that, there I put in some of those, the painters that I was talking about. Some images from so you get a feeling of how they encountered the landscape. In a sense, a painting is also a snapshot. And then I have some archival family footage. So some 8mm films from my grandfather, my grandmother, and a little bit up till now, basically. So you get sort of a nice flow of different sorts of visual information, different sorts of media that I think all come together and tell this story about a long, sort of slow-moving landscape or development.
So that's a good point, because I thought, okay, you tell a story that is taking over a long time.
Yeah.
And how to manage to tell something over such a long period of time within the medium of film.
Yeah.
As you said, you tried by getting some footage, older footage, and you tried by what is very interesting to me to using maps. Mm-hmm. Because in this case, I think you don't, if you go there, you want to have a look at your work. Mm-hmm. You don't even need to read a lot of text before. Maybe it's.
I hope not.
Yeah,
This is. I've made it sort of that. I think, you know, everyone. You don't have to know anything about art or photography. Or
oh,
anything.
That's good.
It almost has a sort of Saturday afternoon documentary feel to it.
Okay.
I think.
Okay.
And the sort of the personal angle, I allow myself to be somewhat romantic and sentimental in it as well, because, you know, that makes it relatable.
Okay. And you use photography also a lot? In this case and in your other bodies of work?
I use a camera a lot.
Yeah. Oh, okay. You use a camera. That's a good point.
I'm originally trained as a painter, so I don't dare call myself a photographer because I didn't. I can't. You know, I don't know how it works really, but I just know that digital cameras are really easy to use.
Yeah.
I work predominantly with at least lens-based media.
Okay. Yeah.
And often over the last years, I've been shooting myself. Yeah.
Okay, so it's a 30-minute video you're going to see.
And there's a small installation next to it of photos and some text that sort of...
You use photographs with photos.
Yeah, there are a few photos. That's true, actually, of my own. But there are also a lot of maps there. So you can go and see and look at the maps, some of those that are in the video. You can go and get a closer look at them.
You have some time to have a closer look.
There's some text, some of the sources I've used. Are also available there. So you can sort of, get a bit of a closer look.
Okay. And as the title of this exhibition is Contested Landscapes, mm-hmm. What do you think why, maybe everyone knows right now, but why you are part of this exhibition? Do you know something about the other works?
I do. And it's interesting. I think, in a sense, I mean, I think all works are different and are there because of their own merits, and every work stands out, of course. I think my work stands out in a little bit of a sense that there's not really a conflict in it. And it's also, it's not very, the topic is very actual.
Mm-hmm.
Climate change, you can put a lot of stuff into it, but it doesn't work around one specific conflict or problem from now. It tries to take a step back and just look at, you know,
what changes
and then the whole notion of preservation and how we interact with stuff. And then also the interactions we have as humans with landscape, whatever the intentions, we don't always know the consequences of them. Mm-hmm. And this is, this can be good or bad. There's no moral question in that, in the work, I think. But we respond to, the situations as we find it. Sometimes we need to farm more land for agriculture, and then, as in this case, too much growth was taken away, too much forest and shrubberies, etc., was taken away, and then it turns into a catastrophe.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the little ice age, which occurred in from the 15th century or 1500s on, where it also played a role in that, and one can question how much, or whether or not that was man or caused by man itself. So maybe it was, maybe it wasn't, maybe it partially was. But it also means that even though we think we control or try to preserve or use the landscape, there are also forces that are just beyond our control.
Okay. And then maybe are there other works you did before that where you tried to figure out how about landscapes? Or was it the first time you found a topic that is about landscapes and change of the environment?
Well, I made the work I made before this was called Mining Town.
About I know.
But it was a bit more of a specific work. But it was a work made in Serbia, in a small town there, which I made with a Serbian friend and photographer, Mikita Andrejc, where we looked at the reopening, or actually the purchase of an old mine in a small town in the southeast of Serbia by a big multinational company, and how that, when that then reopened a couple of years ago and the production was all of a sudden sort of boosted enormously, what consequences that then had for the inhabitants of the city and the landscape, specifically the landscape also.
So will you, with this work, Rabia?
Yeah.
I think it was correctly pronounced. I give it a try. because it's maybe someone asked why I asked this. It's written down Rabjerk, but as you said, it's pronounced Rabia. And will you go on with this? Because the landscape will change in the future.
The landscape keeps changing, yeah. No, I don't think... I don't know. I'm not really that consequent in sort of developing a single line in my work. So I don't think I will continue with landscapes as such. But I do like the notions of sort of questioning the bigger ideas or the more abstract ideas behind the way we act and the way we think.
Because my main question was, is this story finished? The story of Rabia? Is it finished?
No, of course not.
Of course. No, it's not finished for the environment, but is it finished for you?
Oh, it's probably finished. Well, actually, not completely. There's a book in the making of it as well that will be presented here at the Kunsthalle by the end of the biennial.
Yeah.
And I think that will be probably the finishing touches of the work, at least.
Okay.
And... but you never know with these things either. I mean, it might take on a different, slightly different shape or form in the future. There's so much material still, and still a lot of sort of, still some ideas bubbling.
Okay, so where does this work start? Is there a certain point where your work in time starts? You know what I mean?
Not quite.
So the change of environment.
Ah, yeah, okay.
It starts at some point.
Well, I chose the receding of the ice cap 10,000 years ago as a starting point.
Oh, you start 10,000 years ago?
Yeah, okay, why not? That's but we do sort of skip forward quite quickly in the story.
Okay, you skipped?
Well, I mean, you know, the ice melts, land comes up, and then we're...
It's not that easy.
but the span of the story is basically 10,000 years, yeah.
Okay, that's a very long period of time. So
it is. But what was also interesting about it, I think, was that then... So you have sort of a a development of such. And then you have, you know, points where the development speeds up or somehow changes. And that can be then due to, well, I mean, the Ice Age was such an event itself. But also the sand drift and later on the attempt to preserve it.
Okay. So you said there are chapters in this work?
Yeah, they're not really mentioned as such, but they will be in the book, and they are for myself. But you see, every sort of new chapter, as it were, is marked by a new map.
Okay.
And then maps also, you know, these very crude maps where you just see basically, oh, this is Denmark.
So the maps work as indicators, maybe?
Indicators, also to sort of situate you in time. I don't give you the exact dates of the maps,
but you
do get a feeling of, oh yeah, we're progressing all of a sudden. And you also see in the way they get sort of more accurate I think that's interesting. Then you can also use a map in a different way. I mean, the first maps must have been basically worthless, except to say, here's some land that's mine.
Yeah.
And then up until basically Google Maps, you know, and now we can't really live without a map.
You think so? We can't live without a map?
Well, I'm sure we could, but I've been walking around Mannheim today with my phone all the time, so.
Yeah, and you always stop at I always stop at corners to reorganize. I don't stop while walking, walking straight. I always stop at corners to relocate and look where I have to go.
Yeah.
So, but the maps you used are very, there may be some very old maps.
Well, I mean, that's the interesting part. Maps also, I discovered, and I'm by no means an expert on this, but you begin to see the first sort of what we would consider maps. Yeah. There are some from the Roman times, but obviously they're somewhat crude, although still. But then up until around 1400 or something like that, Renaissance, then you start to see the new map, or the maps that we would call maps, or we recognize as maps, come and become really a thing of itself.
Okay, so maybe this is also, if you're interested in maps, you can have a look at your work about how maps change.
Yeah, I would like to think so. There are some really beautiful maps there as well, and also this also has to do with, you know, the time of the explorations or colonization of the world. So, you know, you needed more accurate maps. You needed maps that you could sail with. And then they also start to sort of, the details of the landscape become more important.
Okay.
You need to know, you know, what goods are there. Is there woods? Is it whatever, you know? So the mapping in and of itself, the graphics of a map actually becomes something that also defines the world, but therefore also in a certain sense lays a claim on it. So the later maps I also use are cadastral maps that really talk about, okay, so this is where your land plot stops and this is where mine, etc. And you get this sort of weird numbering of these plots, so that instead of you know, this forest over there is mine, you get, you know, this piece called 13A or something like that is mine.
Okay, so right now we're here, Contested Landscapes, and I'm very excited to have a look at your video and all these maps you told me
and
about.
And maps as well, and family photos.
Family photos,
oh,
and
yeah,
maps and family photos.
Yeah, what more do you want?